and let it sink. I think the they would love to bring this thing back to Texas and probably leave it on the side of the road and have people look at it like it's a dead whale or something. I don't know. We'll look into it when it happens back to you, Wesley.
And wondering why they decided Starship 40 to be afloat. Most of them either landed on the platform or were scrapped. They explode. This one was exploding. What is the reason for it, back to you?
You saw the landing. I mean, it came down very slow. I mean, it went down to 0 miles per hour to get down to the water. And it just, like, slowly went into the water, tail first, and then just, you know, leaned over to the side. The tile side was looking up. You know, they have tiles on half the starship, and that's the way it went. You know, it is a sealed tank. That's really all it is, one big sealed tank. Even with the engines, you know, there's no vent holes or anything. So you know, they're completely blocked off from the rest of it. So you know, there was fuel in it. But I guess, I assume they must have dumped it because you don't want to fool around with something that's got fuel in it. So I haven't heard what they did with that. You know. I don't know. I know he's got a lot of other things on his mind. I'm surprised they're bringing this thing back. You know, he wants to launch another one in probably mid-September.
Comment?
I think Brian wants to say something.
Hi, I'm just, this is Brian, KFQZZ. I'm sorry I'm late to the party, but I am here, and I will stand by.
Okay, thank you, Z. I'm wondering, did they say a word why they want to take a hassle transporting Starship 40 all the way to the United States? Back to you, Paul.
Like I said before, I thought they were just going to scuttle it and just sink it. So the only thing I could think of is that the engineers would like to get a hold of it to see, you know, how the parts worked out during flight. You know, maybe get a microscopic view of some of the parts, you know, the valves and all, you know, turbos and all of that. Well, you know, that's the only thing I can think of. You know, of course, the tiles, they like to get a close up of the tiles, and it looks like they fared pretty well. Although there was something I didn't like, you could see these streaks all over, you know, after it landed. So are those streaks caused from, you know, something floating in the water, or were those streaks caused from the heat, you know, in between all the tiles, you know, similar to like, you know, grout coming out of a tile floor somewhere. So, you know, they'll probably want to look at all of that. And they have the opportunity to do that. It probably cost millions of dollars to bring this all the way back to Houston. Hey, it's only money. Back to you.
Kilo 2, Hotel Zulu Echo, trying to check in. Trying to say hello, give a little word in.
Okay, this is DJ GPS, consider yourself a load.
Well, listen, I've been trying to get in. You guys don't leave pauses. You got a lot of people listening and everything, especially on the Echolink, the other side and everything. You're not leaving pauses, buddy. If you can leave pauses so some of us can get in, over.
Understood. We unfortunately don't have a lot of quick keying people.
No, not if don't apologize. But yeah, if you want people to check in, we can't get a word in. I've been trying for 10 minutes. Other people are listening as well. All right, we'll stand by. Very nice net, but very bad protocol.
Back to you, Wesley.
Okay, do it, Jim. The last one. I'm not sure if Paul had a chance to look at the last email that I have sent. I got August 29 at 9:56 p.m. It was for Paul Envoy, History of Wireless Electromagnetic Light. I'm going to give just a short preamble of it. Today, most of the drones are available for license holders only. Russian Iran cooperation kills innocent Ukrainian. Illegally obtained American, European, and Australian Western technologies found in Chinese DJI 2. And now, AI in hands of Russian choosing who from Ukrainian children stays alive for a little longer. So we're talking about first time in the history of the Earth, not history of human beings, 3.2 million years ago, but the history of entire universe, where machine is killing its own creators. By itself. Machine shoots, who is alive, who is not. That's what happened with Russian drones using NVIDIA chip computers and AI. So that drone, for the first time in the history of the universe, killed its creators and other human beings. By itself. Estimated not enough of fuel to go to the target, are we going to look for another target? So there is a house, there is a propane tanks, and we're going to bomb those propane tanks. We're going to kill the people. So I'm trying to understand, is it true the Russia of today is too deep to have AI of its own? Is it true? Because they, I mean, what do they have? What kind of invention that is significant to the world do they have? Even a nuclear bomb was stolen, possessed, how do we call it, from the United States of America, with Russia. So, is it true to say, because we may ask, we cannot make a statement, but we may ask, is it true to say that Russia today is too dull to have AI on its own? So what they do is they steal NVIDIA, or they steal American. So I'm trying to understand how we got to all of this by analyzing the history of the drones. I sent to you and to Paul article of PhD Dr. R. Iwashko, who actually made a nice history of what the drones come from. If Paul would be, would try to... how much of my transmission you were able to?
I was able to piece it all together, but it was, it was work.
Okay. So we have a short. We have a PhD, John Iwaska, who started from 1893, where in Madison Square Garden, Nikola Tesla presented his flying device. And then we have 1821, British scientist Michael Faraday. In 1883, we have another guy. Then we have, in 1916, birth of successful heavier-than-air radio-controlled flying device. That was after the Wright brothers. And then we have 1964. That was a Bill Brown, the guy who was working with JPL as a director, and he was able to create a helicopter that was able to fly using microwave beams, so it didn't have any battery on it. And based on that, MIT professor Martin Solajatic created wireless power transmission with electricity. And then we have number of guys all together, and it looks like only at 2011, drones started to actually show up in our store, so everybody could buy it. Let me drop. Okay. In 2007, we have that PhD, John Iwaszko, who at 18 megahertz, which is ham radio frequency, was able to demonstrate first ever scale helicopter that flew solely by means of propulsive power delivered by a loop coil. And interesting is the conclusion. It is sufficient to know that in the entire history of unmanned aircraft, not a single Chinese or Russian or Iranian last name appeared in the article. Should we assume that the entire body of knowledge was pilfered and used without permission by some archaic actors who are technologically impotent? Most of you were already married adults with children at high school when all of it started. Back to you, Dr. Roy, for your comment.
Well, I don't know what the point of this exercise might be. The Chinese were impoverished, a third world country. Not that it just happened to them, but the British basically put down. So, you know, it wasn't a situation where they were just gambling or something instead of doing scientific experimentation. You know, the Chinese, unfortunately, didn't get their head above water until, 30, 40 years ago? And the Russians did all kinds of research back before the end of the Soviet Union, but they've been busy stealing from each other since then. So, I mean, that's their problem. Iran, you know, it's a relatively large country, but it's in the Middle East. It's really not in the hub of scientific development. And they sort of keep their discoveries to themselves. They don't really share with the outside world. So, you know, I mean, I'm not going to kind of disdain for Chinese entire race of people just because their scientific research was not as fruitful, you know, in the last 150 years as we were. You know, we were in a different time and a different place in the world.
Okay. Go to the history of that article, the history of drones. We have only 1993 NASA Pathfinder and Helios. It was a series of solar and fuel cell systems powered by unmanned aircraft. Germans in 1996, which was 3 years later, were trying to do the same, and they used Institute of Fulgau and University of Stuttgart for it in 1997, we had the first ever laser power flight with onboard power supply. So that was photonic mechanical pressure, light craft, small laser powered remotely, plasma rocket. It was like, it looks like, gosh, I forgot the name of it, like a cone glued to another cone from the bottom of it, and was like a rocket able to be, if properly guided by laser beam, was able to fly. Then in 2002, we have, the first battery pack, lithium battery pack, motor wing. So we're talking about, most of us in 2002 were already grown up with a future in front of us. Then we have a second laser power flight in Marshall Center, NASA, and that was in 2003. But interesting was that it was hydrogen fuel cell power flight Hornet. The Hornet was used by United States military. The small drone, if you guys remember, the small drone that soldier could put into their shirt pocket and eventually make it fly from the hand. Back to you, Dr. Ray, for a comment.
Okay, I mean, again, I'm kind of lost at, wandering through memory lane here. Is there an ultimate point?
Yeah, the ultimate point is how come the adversaries were able to get a significant role in drones, having no history of doing that. So we're talking about England, we're talking about Australia, we're talking about United States of America, and we're talking about Germany. We're talking about 50 positions that I have in the article of PhD Dr. Iwaszko, showing all of the history of drones. And we don't have a Chinese, we don't have a Russian, and we don't have Iranians. And all of a sudden, we have Iranians delivering to Russia their drones that are being used in Ukraine by Russian. And we're talking about DJI becoming sort of the ultimate, the best of the best company producing drones for the public. How is that happening? Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Their government invested vast quantities of money, which was not financially particularly brilliant, but strategically reasonably a good idea. It's just, if your government wants to pour most of its budget into a field like robotics or batteries or artificial intelligence, then it's possible for your country to jump ahead of the other people. you know, the United States is based, when we're not kind of hysterically crazy about, you know, throwing trillions of dollars at things like artificial intelligence, at investing in something that has a proper financial return. China and Iran isn't that interested in financial return. It's more interested in military supremacy.
So, in other words, could we say that Russia has AI of their own? Or could we say that they don't? Because as far as I know, they don't. If they need something more complicated than a bicycle, they most likely use other people's knowledge. Of course, it's over-exaggerating. Of course, it is not true. But I'm trying to just oppose for the purpose of good of the discussion. Back to the floor.
Yeah, they just use other people's technology. They can't afford to maintain an infrastructure, and if they attempted it, most of the people involved would probably just do it. So, you know, you can buy stuff or have other people steal stuff for you, but you can't. It's a little bit more difficult to build up an industry when everyone and their brother is basically taking bribes.
Okay, thank you. So the question that I asked before, is it true that Russia of today is too dull to have AI of its own, doesn't have to be answered from very much understood reasons. Now, as far as China, I remember there was a time when China said, that was 2 years ago, that they have spent only $5 billion and they have their own AI. What happened to that? Do you have any information, N2HCM?
Yes, China officials lie. They do it regularly. They do it in their sleep. You know, I don't believe their population numbers. I don't believe their economic numbers. I don't even believe a lot of the technology. They usually will fake it if they have to, and, you know, not feel bad about it. So you can't really take them at their word, and you can't even take them directly when they do things that seem to prove a situation. There's always a possibility of them faking it.
Okay. I'm trying to find the best description for the cockroaches. Are those creatures good? Or they are not good for average human being or average American? Back to you and to you.
I don't know what to tell you. I mean, a cockroach is probably only good to another cockroach, I would assume.
Okay. That would be end of the subject discussed. I was trying to be as gentle with wording as possible. Thank you very much, Dr. Boyan, to XG.
You're welcome, Wes, as always. Hank, are you out there? I hope Hank doesn't have any serious problems with his radio. Okay, this is AC2GS with the Limark Technical Net. We're still open for business. We got lots of time. And David is aboard, and Brian is aboard. And other people, no doubt, are aboard. So if anyone wants to put their name on the list for tonight, please hit that push-to-talk in ID.
Question.
Yes.
Regarding off-center fed antennas, such as an off-center fed wire antenna, do those always need a tuner, or is it resonant on some frequency that you don't need to use a tuner?
Yeah, for the most part, you know, unless you're really bad at designing things, you're going to find some resonant frequency, and hopefully you'll design it so that resonant frequency will happen to exist in the amplitude band. But the nature of off-center, I was curious the way you phrased that, because can you possibly imagine what an off-center non-wire antenna might look like?
Correct. Well, it's, you know, when you look at it, I should say NFED at that point, NFED through an UNIN. But what I was trying to get at, actually, was that is it possible to either add or subtract wire from that antenna with a formula to either shift up the resonance or decrease the resonance on a band. In other words, let's say I wanted to go and have it more resonant on 28 megahertz, 10 meters, versus 7 megahertz, 40 meters. Is there a way to do that with a formula, or is it just basically a little, you know, try and fail kind of thing?
You can approximate with formulas, but edge effect and such is going to screw that up. It's always good to kind of you're basically describing a stepper antenna that uses stepper motors to mechanically extend and shorten the length of radiating elements of an antenna.
Well, actually, on my new antenna, it's very, very good on 60 meters, but it's not very good in 10 meters. And I was thinking if I went ahead and, you know, if I either now have to, I would think that you would probably have to shorten the wire, but if you did that, would it make it a little bit more resonant on the 10-meter band so you could go ahead and tune it within the parameters of the auto-tuner, which is about roughly 8 to 1?
Well, the short answer is yes. If you mechanically change the dimensions of a radiator, you shift its resonance. So if it's you know, by wavelength, if it's 10 meters and it started out as a 30 or a 60 meter antenna, you would have to shrink it up to the size of a 10 meter and then it would become mechanically resonant. You could resonate an antenna either by mechanically changing the dimensions or electrically introducing inductance or capacitance in order to shift the resonant circuit that is the antenna to 10 meters in your case.
Okay, that I understand. I agree with you. But let's take this a step further. On these NFED antennas, or also known as off-center fed, if you go ahead and want to, how should I say, I just lost my thought for half a second here. Let's say I wanted to go ahead and change the resonance, okay? As I go up in terms of frequency, I would have to take off some, but is there an exact formula or is it just trial and error?
Again, there are approximate formulas, but unfortunately, theoretical is not as practical, and they do introduce variations. Also, you know, something as simple as how far away from Earth ground you are is going to shift somewhat the resonant frequency. So there's a lot of factors that change things. So it's not like you get a very nice computer and put in a really sophisticated program, and you get out to the 16th of an inch, the length of all the elements. It's not going to work that way. That's why usually when commercial antennas are manufactured, they tend to be made a little bit longer far easier to cut something down than to extend something.
Okay. Well, here's the ultimate question. These antennas operate off NFED half waves. Let's say, for example, I don't even want to use the term half wave because that depends on the resonant frequency. But these NFED antennas, okay, these OCFs, they operate on harmonics. And what I'm curious to know is, what would generate the first harmonic and subsequent harmonics that are resonant? That confuses me a little bit, how the other harmonics are generated or what generates those harmonics for resonancy.
Well, that gets very, very esoteric and into antenna design, which I mentioned before. I once got a college textbook on antenna design and it gave me a nosebleed. So suffice it to say that different antenna designs have some are monoband by nature and others are capable of operating at harmonics like a NFET. Now, there are issues with the harmonics in that harmonics are not perfect in the case of an NFET. So you need to do a little electronic correction of going up the harmonics, and a lot of NFET have introduced either a small capacitor or a small inductor along the path of the NFET to nudge it into the amateur radio band, harmonic frequencies.
That would make sense because my antenna does have, I think it's a capacitor built in line with the antenna, I think it's capacitance that's what's doing it, and shifting something to make it more resonant on usually these bands. But yet, on 10 meters, okay, it's not as resonant as I would like it to be. Is that a design issue, or is that more of a, what variables? You mentioned earth ground, okay? Are we talking about grounding the antenna, or are we talking about the distance from the antenna to earth?
The distance. That could shift the resonance. It might be that the device that's being used to kind of nudge your harmonics isn't nudging them enough when it gets all the way up to 10 meters. You know, these things have a progressive effect. And so if you kind of nudge the longer wavelength, by the time you get to the shorter wavelength, it might not have quite enough of. Have you considered sweeping it with a VNA and seeing what the numbers really look like?
It just so happens I have my antenna analyzer, and I'm going to be putting it on there on the line within the next couple of days. But I just wanted to go ahead and find out. And, the developer of the antenna explains to me that it could do, 60 to 10 meters. And I'm saying to myself, well, not quite, like part of 60 and part of 10. It's a compromise.
Yeah, sometimes it's a matter of boxing. I see what develops and perhaps contact the manufacturer and ask them if there's a modification changing that component to a different value that might get better results on 10 meters.
All right. Last part of my overall question, or should I say, I don't know what part I put it into, but it is the last part. If you wanted to take the antenna and you really wanted to, there's no gain in a wire antenna, from what I understand and what I've learned. Is there any way to increase the gain on a wire antenna, by, let's say, running couple of times, or is that just not the solution?
That's not the solution. Actually, what you're really talking about, again, physicists, I love them, but I wish they had some guy with a dictionary who could come up with better ways of phrasing things. To me, gain implies amplification. You know, a powered amplifier has a gain of a signal. Antennas do not increase, passive antennas do not increase the signal. They redirect the signal. They'll take a signal that is possible to act like a light bulb, isochronic, and direct it into a much more narrow cone. It's more directional. It's stronger, but in a small portion of the area. So, do you really need a directional antenna? There's really nothing. You know, directional antennas are things like Yagis and such. When you get to just a standard wire antenna, you might get a 2 decibel gain, but that's really not that much.
Okay, now what I meant to say, to clarify that piece, was the gain on receive, not on transmit. What I'm looking to do is see if there's any little electronic way of tweaking this antenna, and I don't think there is, to increase the gain by maybe 1 or 2 decibels.
Yeah, there's no nice formula for something like that. You just have to move it around until you got a little bit more gain, and it would be rather difficult to measure. You know, if you happen to have a jet propulsion lab in your car, you put it into a sophisticated array of RF meters and computers that integrate it across the 360 and figure out what the gain is. Otherwise, you could run it through an antenna simulator, and if you got all the stuff right, might give you some vague idea that you're going in the right direction. I don't think it's worth the effort, really.
Okay, so the wire antenna, I am very, very well, I'm immobilized in that respect. But if I put on a Yagi or something with more elements, it would be more directional, but there would be more receive gain. Would that be correct?
Yeah, in that direction. Overall signal strength, if you integrate it across 360 degrees, it would turn out about the same. But, you know, in a given direction, it puts out more signal in that subset of the, you know, the world around you. And by the way, anything that you do to an antenna that affects its reception also affects its transmission. There's something called antenna reciprocity. There's some differences, that complicate things, but for all intents and purposes, anything that leads to an effect on the received signal can be demonstrated on the transmitted signal.
Okay, agreed. And just one more sub-question. if you have an antenna like an OptiBeam, are those multiple bands, or are they strictly like usually with 1 or 2? I'll say again.
Are they Yagis?
I heard of the product called an OptiBeam. I don't know what design it is. If it's a Yagi or a variation on it. So maybe I thought that you perhaps might know what the difference is.
One sec. I think it's a Yagi, or at least it's actually a company, but the company makes Yagis.
All right. So if it's a Yagi, then if you were to add or remove elements, obviously that would affect the whole bunch of variables. So it's basically when I when I see these people with these huge towers and they have several different types of antennas, are they basically working on multiple bands, or are they usually working on like a mono band? To me, it looks like they would have multiple different antennas from multiple bands. Would I be correct in that statement?
Well, I mean, if you're just generally talking about Yagis are directional antennas. You can have a monoband Yagi, or you can place traps in the radiating, reflecting, and forward-going elements and have a multiband Yagi. The purest kind of thing is stacking different resonant Yagis on top of a tower. And, you know, then you could operate, you just twirl the switch and however you have it configured, and go from band to band.
All right. So, in closing, basically, what antenna do you have, and is it a mono band, or do you have, like, for example, a fan dipole and able to switch between each of those, or a hex beam, for example?
Well, in the good old days, I had fan dipoles. I had two or three of them. I liked them a lot, but wire antennas can be fragile, especially during windy days, and they all kind of snapped away, and I'm between them now. The benefit of a fan dipole is that all the bands are functional all the time, so you don't really have to do any switching. I could plug my fan dipole into my Flex 6700, which was capable of visualizing eight different synthesized receivers, and I could have most of the HF bands displayed simultaneously receiving the same fan dipole.
So with the fan dipole, you don't have to switch from one wire to another wire to get it exact. How does it actually distribute throughout the whole antenna then? Would it be wasting energy on one band that it wouldn't be resonant on, or multiple bands?
Not really. The beauty of a fan dipole is it kind of selects the path depending upon the frequency of the signal you're sending it. It's the impedances are different depending upon the frequency. So an element that is cut for 10 meters is going to, the current is going to select for the most part that element versus the 40-meter element or the 20-meter element. And, you know, same goes with the 40-meter signal will prefer, will be, perceive a better conductivity in the element that it's designed to radiate from. So it kind of self-selects dependent upon the transmission frequency and, the antenna's design.
So if you had, let's say, a fan dipole with, let's say, for example, we'll make it simple, we'll just say, let's say 60 meters, 20 meters, 40 meters, and 10 meters on that. Are you saying that no RF energy would be distributed to the other wires, only to the one that has the most resonance?
It would be inconsequential amount.
Okay, the only thing is that with a fan dipole, you have to go ahead and have it dead center pretty much. So is there any way that could be offset, or that negates the whole entire, idea of the fan dipole?
Theoretically, I guess you could do it. I haven't seen anyone write anything up about that, but there's no particular limitation. It just makes it difficult on a theoretical basis and a mechanical basis. Just a lot easier to handle symmetrical devices that are balanced, both physically and electronically.
My issue is that I can't drop the coax in the middle. It just will not suit the way my property is architected. So I wondered if you went ahead and shifted it to a side, or even used a sort of like some sort of mechanism to divert the cable physically to, let's say, the left or the right. Would it still work, or is that central part still going to radiate?
Well, yeah, it'll radiate, but I mean, you can divert the transmission line. The transmission line doesn't have to go from the center straight to the ground. You could split it somehow and extend it to the right or the left and drop it down towards the length of the antenna.
Okay. Now, I think you're giving me some ideas here that I'd like to go ahead and study up on. But in terms of the gain on each wire, it's going to be the lack of receive gain is going to be the same. Would you agree?
If you're talking about a fan dipole, for all intents and purposes, is basically a center dipole. And it has a gain of 2.15 decibels. That's kind of what you get.
And a wire antenna?
Well, again, wire antenna is a much more general term. It's like the difference between a cube, a rectangle, and a square. Anything made out of wire is a wire antenna. So a center-fed dipole, a fan dipole, an off-center, and fed, you know, there's a lot, even a loop is a wire antenna. So it's not a great term for technical.
All right, this involves some self-study on my part, because with a wire antenna, let's say, for example, my NFED half-wave, which is more resonant on 60 meters, okay, if you had a fan dipole and it's using individual wires for each particular band, wouldn't that be the same as, I don't understand how it could have a receive gain on it, because it's only using one element per band.
It's because by its nature, it's a series of parallel center-fed dipoles combined together. And so a center-fed dipole, by definition, if you put it through an antenna calculator, gives you a gain of approximately 2.15 decibels, as opposed to something that has an emission similar to a light bulb.
Okay. I will go ahead and do some more research on this. I want to thank you very much for your commentary and knowledge. I appreciate it. And, you know, I'll revisit this at some point. Okay. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Brian. I look forward to future conversations about this antenna and other things.
2SDP?
Yes, Chris.
Hi, Roy, thanks. With this fan dipole, I assume all of those elements are always receiving, and it's really just at the receiver transmitter that it's filtering out the other bands and only pulling the one that you're actually listening to. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. In the same way that a transmission signal going into the fan dipole will select the resonant element simply because its impedance is matching that of the rest of the system, and that determines how much energy is transferred. And the same thing happens on a receiver, you know, that, you know, you're sitting there and you get a signal on 40 meters. It embeds the entire antenna. It's the 40-meter element that's cut to the length where its impedance will match the rest of the transmission line, and most of the energy will be drawn into the receiver circuits.
So that sounds like you're saying something is switching besides the transceiver. I'm just referring to receiving only.
So if you're receiving, well, I guess, yeah, you only have one receiver. Never mind, I'm thinking there's a receiver receiving all those bands at once, and that's not the case. But I would assume on the feed line, that antenna is receiving all those bands. It's all coming down the feed line, and your transmitter is only set up to receive whatever band you have it tuned to, so you're only catching that. That's kind of what I'm referring to, if you understand that. Hard thing to explain.
Okay, yeah, I mean, as far as a receiver, it sort of depends. Most people have a receiver that receives one frequency at a time. My Flex 6700 is capable of doing that with 8 different signals. So, and I've done that in the past, where I up on my computer at my desk, and I see a whole bunch of different bands. Each of the legs of the fan dipole efficiently receive a certain set of frequency ranges, and they can simultaneously go down the coax and simultaneously go into the radio, and there a splitter will split off the output to the eight receivers. It's really two hardware receivers, but each hardware receiver has virtual receivers. So it's possible to multiplex multiple frequencies down through a same transmission line.
Comment.
Sure, Brian.
Okay. On your fan dipole, how many bands does it cover?
It covered 10, 20, 40, and 80.
Okay. Would you agree with the statement that it has four wires of differing lengths?
Okay.
All right. So wouldn't each wire only receive properly on the frequency that it was resonant on?
Yes.
Okay, then how do you get 2.5 decibel gain out of it?
Again, it's a phenomena. It's not a phenomena of being a fan dipole. Being a fan dipole is incidental. It's a center-fed dipole. All center-fed dipoles have a 2.15 decibel gain over a isotropic light bulb-like radiator.
Is it because the signal is split in the middle that it diverges to the right and left on each wire?
Not exactly, but the radiation pattern favors the right and left portion of the dipole elements. And you get a little bit of a loss at an angle from them.
So when you transmit, basically, there's no tuning necessary. It automatically, like you said, it goes to the point of the, well, I don't want to use the term least resistance, but the point of the most resonance for each band that you're on. Am I correct in saying this?
Yeah, potato, potato. Each of those have its own impedance at a given frequency, and the thing that determines whether the antenna is resonant is that it has an impedance that is the same as the rest of the transmission line. Again, the whole point of the exercise should be the way to transfer the most amount of energy from source to load is to maintain a identical impedance across the entire circuit.
So each element of the fan dipole is tuned or attenuated for 50 ohms.
Yeah. Well, again, it sort of depends upon what's going on, what the design is, what resonant impedances are. But generally speaking, you know, once you get to a certain point, you have a balun that's kind of adjusting your radiator's impedance usually to the 50 ohms that the transmission line is designed for and the receiver and transmitter optimized for.
Okay, last thought. If you, I would assume that if they're resonant on those particular bands, then you don't need to use an antenna tuner. Am I correct? Or use the one within your rig?
Well, I mean, you could use whatever one you prefer in your rig or one. The problem is that not all antennas have a wide reception bandwidth. So you might be able to optimize some portion of 80 meters, but if you really want to use the entire 80 meter band, you probably end up having to use an antenna tuner to kind of tweak it to a better number.
November 2.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you, Roy.
Okey-doke. John, what do you got for me?
Yeah, I noticed when you were given the other station, the frequencies on that fan dipole, I know you mentioned 40 meters, but you skipped 15. Is there something with the fan dipole that it doesn't work on harmonics? I would have just assumed if you constructed it with a 40-meter radiator wire, that it would also radiate on 15. Am I missing something here?
No, you might need to tweak it a little bit more, but yeah, usually, with at least the companies we've been involved with, they tend to kind of not really deal with harmonics as much as just the actual elements that are built into the design.
Yeah, I'm going to read up on it because, I'm wondering if there's something going on with the interaction with the other ones. I mean, regular dipole, I know you know, a 40 meter would definitely resonate very well on 15. So, I just don't see at first glance any reason why it wouldn't, but there may be a reason. So, okay, back to that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a fan dipole at one time for, in the front, and I set one up for 80, and I set one up for 40, and like you said, I did get 15 out of 40, so, I was able to get, an extra band, it was like a free band, and it did work. Back to you.
Okay, it really depends upon the advertising. Also, I never used 15 meters, so I could have had 15, and I never got around to it. So, functionally, yeah, because it operates a little different. It operates with harmonics of a longer piece of wire.
Yeah, comment. Good. So, and this was homebrew, so I did not buy this. So that, whatever came out, and it, like you said, 40 definitely, the 40 part of it was good for 40 and 15. So I got 80, 40, and 15 out of it.
November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Yeah, John?
Yeah, Paul, since this is the topic at the moment, and you built your own, what are your comments on the fan dipole? Were you happy with the results, or were there any complications when using it? Favored one band or more, or did it lose its resonance with the weather more? Anything at all. Anything you could share with that would be interesting.
Okay, my backyard was big enough.